To the truth is so boring. My name is Scott. My pronouns are he and him.
My name is Owen. My pronouns also he and him.
This episode of The Truth is So Boring is broadcast live on January 20th at 9 a.m. This episode will conclude a three-part series we've been doing every other episode based on a series of articles titled A Chemical Hunger. In episode 22 of The Truth is So Boring, we aired aired Thanksgiving morning, November 25th, 2021. We outlined the first two articles in the series. The first article outlines eight mysteries.
Starting with...
There is endemic levels of obesity. Number two, this was a sudden shift. People began getting fatter and very suddenly and rapidly starting in the late 70s or 80s.
This trend has continued, despite a great effort to reverse it. There is a notable exception to this trend, hunter-gatherer societies.
Number five, lab animals and wild animals are also becoming more obese.
Six, rodents eating diets that are only high in fat or only high in carbs don't gain nearly as much weight as rodents eating a cafeteria diet of foods like Fruit Loops, Doritos, salami, pork rinds, and wedding cake.
Number seven, people who live at higher altitudes have lower rates of obesity.
And eight, diet and exercise help, but not nearly enough to explain or solve the problem.
We then read from the second article in the series, which outlines how our current theories of obesity are completely inadequate to explain the extent to which obesity has spread. You can download that episode from our website, where we have links as well to the original articles, which itself contains many inline sources. In the next episode, aired December 24th, 2021, we read from parts 3 and 4 of the series. Part 3 outlines a hypothesis which does explain the obesity epidemic, environmental contaminants. Part 4 outlines requirements for what those contaminants might look like, as well as things which can be ruled out.
So in this episode, we allow the articles to propose some contaminants that we think might be responsible for the obesity epidemic, and hopefully wrap up the series with a note on what you or I can actually do about it, as opposed to what we are told to do, which turns out to not work.
But we should make it clear up front that the theory itself doesn't hinge on the contaminants we're about to outline, even if it turns out that none of these compounds could possibly be responsible for the modern rise in obesity. We still think the evidence is very strong that environmental contaminants are responsible.
So let's take a close look at three contaminants and examine the evidence for each. Part 5, Livestock Antibiotics. The Frontiers in Public Health article titled Obesity in the United States, Dysbiosis from Exposure to Low-Dose Antibiotics, suggests that the obesity epidemic is driven by population-wide exposure to residual antibiotics from livestock cultivation and the resulting impact on gut microbiota.
They make a pretty compelling case. A large percentage of antibiotics are excreted in animal waste and end up in the water supply, where they affect natural microorganisms. Exposure has increased in the U.S. over time, closely matched with the increasing prevalence of obesity, practically overlapping with the counties with the highest obesity prevalence in the U.S.
The article goes into some detail and then concludes, "This isn't necessarily a smoking gun. At best, it is consistent with the idea that some of these contaminants are more prevalent in animal-based foods. And we know that this can't be about the animal products themselves, because hunter-gatherers and our ancestors in 1890 ate lots of meat and didn't experience modern levels of obesity." Sorry, vegans.
Environmental contaminants tend to build up in animals through the plants they eat, so any contaminants in the environment will bioaccumulate, and concentrations will be higher in animals than in groundwater or in plants. Compounds in farmers' fields will end up in the corn or alfalfa fed to their cows, and cows will end up getting an even larger dose, which will be passed on to the person who eats the resulting cheeseburger. So the fact that meat consumption is linked to obesity doesn't necessarily implicate antibiotics. It could be something else in the meat.
Environmental contaminants tend to build up in animals. We just read that. I copied this paragraph in twice. My bad.
Oh, interesting.
All right.
So that's the first potential environmental contaminant.
Antibiotics in the groundwater that bioaccumulate up the food chain. So the next one are PFAS, sometimes pronounced PFAS, sometimes pronounced polyfluoroalkyls.
Polyfluoroalkyl.
And perfluoroalkyls as well. I think I'm going to stick to PFAS because that sounds best to me. They are a group of synthetic chemicals that are used to make a wide variety of everyday products, including food packaging, carpets, rugs, firefighting foams, upholstered furniture, nonstick cookware, water repellent outdoor gear like tents and jackets, ski wax, clothing, and cleaning products. Many are also used in industrial, aerospace, construction, automotive, and electronic applications.
PFAS are practically indestructible. They repel oil and water and are heat resistant, which is part of why they have so many applications. But all these features also ensure that they degrade very slowly in the environment, if they degrade at all. As a result, they stick around in the environment for a very long time, and soon make their way into soil and groundwater. The full picture is complicated, but there's evidence that they accumulate in rivers as they flow towards the ocean.
They also stick around for a long time in your body. If you're listening to this, there's probably PFAS in your blood. A CDC report from 2016 found PFAS in the blood of 97% of Americans. That's more Americans than have herpes virus.
Mm-hmm.
That's 90%, by the way.
I was going to say COVID, but they were making a running for that.
Not quite, but they're trying to get us there, that's for darn sure. How do these chemicals get into our bodies? Every route imaginable. People are concurrently exposed to dozens of PFAS chemicals daily. The NRDC report explains, through their drinking water, food, air, indoor dust, carpets, furniture, personal care products, and clothing. As a result, PFAS are now present throughout our environment and in the bodies of virtually everyone.
The exposure isn't just limited to humans. There's bioaccumulation in the remote lichen caribou wolf food chain in northern Canada, in part of the Arctic Ocean, with animals higher in the food chain showing higher concentration of PFAS in their bodies.
Notably absent from both the Red Cross and the NHANES data is PTFE, also known as Teflon. This is somewhat surprising, given that PTFE is the original PFAS, and it is still in production. Granted, many sources claim that Teflon is extremely inert, including the paper Polytetrafluoroethylene Ingestion as a Way to Increase Food Volume and Hence Satiety Without Increasing Calorie Content, which goes on to argue that we should replace up to 25% of our food with Teflon powder so that we feel more full while eating fewer calories, which they say will help us make the leap into the realm of zero-calorie foods. Personally, we'd rather stick to celery.
Yeah. If we look at the history of PFAS, we see that the timeline for PFAS introduction lines up pretty well with the timeline for the obesity epidemic. PFAS were invented in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s and rolled out over the next couple decades. This gave them some time to build up in people's bodies and in the environment. The safety research on these substances is pretty ridiculous. Usually the exposure period is very short and the dose is extremely high. This may be relevant to exposures for industrial workers, but it doesn't tell us much about the long-term effects of relatively low doses on the rest of us. The type of exposure might make the difference. Mice have very different developmental trajectories than we do, but mice exposed to low doses of PFOA in utero had higher body weights at low exposures, while mice exposed to high doses in the adults lost weight.
By the way, I feel like we forgot to mention this when we first opened the show, but you're here listening to WIOX Community Radio, 91.3 FM, here in the Catskill Mountains, also at MTC Cable Channel 20, on the campus of SUNY Delhi at 107.5 FM, and of course, everywhere across the world at WIOXradio.org and or on your mobile device with any FM radio app.
To go on with the article, it doesn't seem likely that humans can be exclusively prenatal.
The effect, that
oh,
is.
Oh, okay. However, because we know that people often gain weight when they move to a more obese country, there's pretty good evidence that environmental contaminants are exposing you to different levels of contamination and that it makes a difference.
Your drinking water is not the only way to be exposed. Many foods are contaminated with PFAS. If your favorite beer or pasta sauce is bottled at a factory where the water source is high in PFAS, you'll be exposed even if your own drinking water is uncontaminated.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk about occupational hazards.
Mm-hmm. One place you might get a lot of reliable exposure is at your job. PFAS are common in firefighting foams, cookware and food packaging, paints and varnishes, cleaning products, automotive applications, including components in the engine, fuel systems, and brake systems, as well as automotive interiors like stain-resistant carpets and seats, or healthcare applications, both in medical devices like pacemakers and in medical garments, drapes, and curtains.
This suggests that if PFAS are linked to obesity, we should expect to see disproportionate levels of obesity in firefighters, food workers, especially cooks, construction workers, professional cleaners, auto mechanics and others who work closely with vehicles, and medical professionals. The article goes on to describe data from a survey done by the Washington Department of Labor and Industries in the early 2000s, which matches the data of which matches pretty closely to the predictions outlined above. That we'll make the table available on the notes of our show, and also they are available in line at the article itself at slimemoldtimemold.com, part six?
Six. Overall, when we look at professions we would expect to have high exposure of PFAS, we see that the workers in those professions are more obese than average. When you look at professions where... with high rates of obesity, we see that most of them are related to mechanical work, healthcare, cleaning, or firefighting, all professions which have disproportionate exposure to PFAS on the job.
If on the job PFAS exposure really does lead to obesity, we should also see higher levels of obesity in people who work with them directly, and that is exactly what we find. Dose-dependent relationships in the population. We're going to mostly skip over this section, but I'll give you a quick summary. It's better read than said. There are a couple sections that are very numbers heavy, and you would just be bored listening to us talk about them. It'd be much easier to grok if you read it. So you can find the articles, all of these, at simultimold.com if you're interested in expanding your own research into this subject. In this section, the author describes and discusses various data comparison errors made by researchers in the courses of writing up their conclusions. And while it's informative and worth understanding, it's really not formatted for the spoken word. So other considerations. Dose dependence is strong evidence that PFAS are a contributor to the obesity epidemic, but is there any other lingering evidence?
DuPont built the very first Teflon plant in Parkersburg, West Virginia. By 1948, the plant was manufacturing 2 million pounds of PTFE per year. That's Teflon. Some sources claim that they were using PFOA as part of the manufacturing process by 1951. Unfortunately, we don't have obesity data for West Virginia in 1948 or 1951 or the years immediately following. But we can note that many years later, West Virginia was at the center of the very first legal action surrounding PFAS.
This kind of legal action has come about because PFAS have been linked to a variety of harmful health effects. As a result, governments, including those of the states of New York, in which we live, Maine, and Washington State, have begun to regulate and sometimes ban these compounds. Some people are hopeful that these bans will form a sort of natural experiment that can allow us to see what happens when PFAS are removed from the environment. Unfortunately, we're less optimistic. First of all, these compounds are very durable, so even if we ban them, huge doses will still be in the environment. Second, statewide bans won't keep these substances from entering the state in food or goods produced elsewhere. Finally, these bans restrict only a small percentage of all PFAS. Efforts to limit exposure to PFAS are a great idea, but the continued use of short-chain PFAS limits the usefulness of bans as natural experiments to determine the role in obesity. All right, part 7, lithium.
This is the next in our series of hypothesized potential environmental contaminants which could be causing the endemic levels of obesity which can be observed in modern society.
Which have been observed to be much greater than those prior to about 1960.
1970s, yeah. Lithium is an element, so it isn't synthetic, of course. But it can still be an environmental contaminant. While it occurs naturally in small concentrations in groundwater, human activity might have led to serious increases over the past few decades.
Unlike the other contaminants we've reviewed, we don't need to spend any time convincing you that lithium makes people gain weight. It does. Almost everyone who takes lithium at therapeutic levels gains some weight. About half of them report serious weight gain, on average 22 pounds, and about 20% of them gain even more than that. Weight gained is correlated with dosage.
We don't have reliable historical data regarding concentrations of lithium over time. While it's easy to detect, assessing lithium levels is not part of the standard analysis for drinking water. There aren't even EPA standards for lithium levels in drinking water.
There also doesn't seem to be any data. There also doesn't seem to be any data on serum lithium levels in the general population. The NHANES data has records of how much uranium there was in your urine every year from 2000 to 2016, but not a single measure related to lithium. Great job, guys.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I was trying to look at what NHANES means. Could you go on reading?
We can't talk about trends in the groundwater or in people's bodies directly, but what we can do is look at other trends that we would expect to be related. For example, we can look at lithium production. Almost no lithium was produced before 1950, so human activity couldn't have been adding a meaningful amount to the groundwater before then. Serious.
It's a National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey. Sorry about that.
No worries. Serious lithium production. I thought I included that in the notes, but it must have gotten cut. Serious lithium production started around 1950, which could help explain why obesity went from about 3% in 1890 to about 10% in 1980. But we see that lithium production truly spikes around 1980. While there have been a few ups and downs, production as a rule has continued to rise ever since.
The author then spends some time looking at some examples of how elevation and lithium accumulation in water supply may or may not correlate to obesity levels. The therapeutic dose of lithium in blood serum is usually considered to be in the range of 0.8 to 1.2 millimoles per liter, or 2,800 to 5,600 nanograms per milliliter.
That's quite a lot. In comparison, lithium levels in groundwater rarely exceed 200 nanograms per milliliter. But perhaps surprisingly, even very low levels can have an influence on our health and mental states. One study examining data from 27 Texas counties between 1978 and 1987 found that rates of suicide and homicide, as well as other forms of violent and impulsive behavior, were negatively correlated with lithium in drinking water. Over water lithium levels ranging from about only 70 to 170 nanograms per milliliter. Another study looking at various cities in Lithuania, no relation to lithium, found a negative relationship between lithium exposure and suicide. The lithium levels in the public drinking water systems they examined ranged from 0.5 to 35.5 nanograms per milliliter, with a median level of 3.6 nanograms per milliliter. In general, reviews of this literature find that trace levels of lithium have a meaningful impact on behavior.
I found this to be very interesting on, like, more than just the grounds of like the obesity and its relation to that, but like just like the behavioral effects. That's like really interesting.
Maybe I'd like to try some lithium. I'll go call my psych.
I don't know about that.
And I just have a note here to myself, because I really wanted to make this comment on, you know, how obesity is seen as a either a decision people make or a moral problem,
yeah.
A disease of self-control. But the presence of lithium correlating with increased obesity as well as stabilized mood, like, kind of ruins that thought.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean...
Well, yeah, so, like, if you're having something which affects your ability which affects your self-control and also makes you more obese, then that kind of means that it's, again, like, one of the reasons I like this so much is because it's like, it's not your fault, you know?
And it explains why. It doesn't just, you know, tell you what you want to hear. Which a lot of literature on how to not be fat or whatever seems to be all about just telling you what you want to hear, which is, well, you're thin because you made the right choices, as opposed to, you know, you're thin because you live in a place with nice water and few contaminants, which people have much less control over, especially people with less money.
Yep.
There's only one randomized controlled trial examining the effects of trace amounts of lithium, but it finds the same thing. A group of former drug users, most of them with a history of violent crime or domestic violence, were given either 400 micrograms per day of lithium orally or a placebo. For comparison, a normal clinical dose is 300,000 to 660,000 micrograms, taken 2 to 3 times per day. Even on this comparatively tiny dose of only 400 micrograms, everyone in the lithium group reported feeling happier, more friendly, more kind, less grouchy, etc., over a 4-week period without exception.
In the placebo group, people were just about as grouchy as before. When they switched the placebo group over to lithium, these people responded in exactly the same way.
This is pretty strong evidence that even very small doses of lithium can have meaningful effects.
A serum level in the range of 10 nanograms per milliliter is enough to influence mood, while a dose of 400 micrograms per day is enough to get you there. And a dose of 400 micrograms a day is enough to get you there. Whether lower doses have an effect is unclear, but we should certainly be interested in numbers in these ranges and up.
So we've identified sort of the amount of the baseline amount of lithium in groundwater you might want to look at or find, and then check the obesity rates to see whether or not your prediction that obesity is correlated with lithium in the groundwater is correct or not, which is exactly what the author goes on to do.
There aren't any other randomized controlled trials, but if trace amounts are enough to cause obesity, then we should see a relationship between trace lithium levels and obesity rates. The author explores this possible relationship in detail. A couple sections follow for the sake of time.
Chile and Argentina are the most obese countries in South America, 28% each, and are two of the biggest exporters of lithium in the world. Unsurprisingly, this is reflected in their groundwater, the details of which are listed on Slime Old Time Old article, but we are not going to read out because that will just be boring.
And take a lot of time, which we have a limited amount of.
Yep.
These are all freshwater levels. In seawater, lithium concentrations are reliably quite high, ranging from 100 nanograms per milliliter to over 1,000 nanograms per milliliter.
One mystery we haven't mentioned yet is that in the Middle East, the Middle East is extremely obese, one of the most obese regions on Earth. These countries are very dry, and so all of them get a lot of drinking water from desalinated seawater. Saudi Arabia gets about half of its total drinking water from desalination and is one of the most obese nations on Earth.
So that's basically like being at the bottom of the water table. As far down as you can get.
It's actually even worse. Desalination removes all trace elements from seawater, but because distilled water corrodes metal pipes and trace elements are important to health, the desalinated water is remineralized by blending it with 5 to 10% brackish water.
Oh.
This means that desalinated water could easily have lithium concentrations of up to 100 nanograms per milliliter, possibly even more.
Oh.
Because they just put the water right back in.
Mm-hmm.
On average, people drink about 3 liters of water per day. If they're drinking from a normal freshwater source with 1 to 10 nanograms per milliliter, they'll get a dose of about 3 to 30 nanograms a day. If they're drinking from sources like those found in Graz, Chile, and Argentina with 1,000 nanograms per milliliter, they'll easily get a dose of 3,000 micrograms a day or more, which is plenty enough to cause physiological and behavioral effects.
Mm-hmm. Many people are getting doses of similar amounts in their drinking water alone, and this is assuming they're not exposed to lithium in other ways, which they probably are, because lithium has a wide variety of applications, including batteries, ceramics, lubrication, miscellaneous industrial uses like polymer production and air treatment.
About half of all lithium that is mined and used today is used for batteries.
Yeah. Which, well, I mean, it just strikes me that, like, maybe electric cars aren't the answer to, you know, our problems if that means that we're also exposing ourselves to a bunch of lithium, which is making us unhealthy.
You'll remember from our review in the PFAS section that some of the most obese professions include firefighters, cooks, food workers, cleaners, motor vehicle operators and mechanics, transportation, healthcare support and technicians, and construction workers. If you go and see your local auto mechanic, the black smears covering his hands and forearms might be lithium grease. This grease is ubiquitous in auto engineering.
Oh, that's true. I've used that a bunch.
Aviation. My grandpa, like, constantly. Aviation, and on many kinds of heavy machinery, as well as a number of household applications. We might put it on the hinges of the door.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to any lithium that they're exposed to in the food and water, these workers, and these people, are also constantly exposed to lithium grease at work, or in the garage, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Lithium is also used in building materials like cement and agrochemicals like pesticides, though information on exactly what agrochemicals on this includes is spotty. Thanks, intellectual property. Mm-hmm. It's possible that this explains the high levels of obesity in food workers.
Lithium grease isn't considered food safe, and in theory it shouldn't be used on food handling equipment. In practice, however, manufacturers and restaurants don't always, if ever, follow regulations.
Yeah, like nothing works like lithium grease. There's nothing to, you know...
You can't replace it with graphite, yeah. Sorry. A quick Google search reveals incidents like lithium grease being stored with food equipment, lithium grease being stored next to garlic bulbs, and lithium grease being stored above mustard. It's not clear if there's a connection with the other types of workers. Maybe there's a hidden lithium connection out there, but there doesn't have to be. Lithium may just be part of the story. The rest could be explained by other contaminants like PFAS. And speaking of PFAS, there's actually a connection. Lithium grease often includes other substances to improve their performance, including Teflon.
Oh, man. Under the heading subheading bioaccumulation, one strike against lithium as an explanation for the obesity epidemic is that the medical consensus seems to be that it doesn't probably bioaccumulate. But this may not be a problem for a few reasons. First, lithium may be able to affect weight without accumulating in the body. Environmental contaminants can also affect body weight through the gut biome, which lithium is shown to do in rats. Second, the medical consensus on how to measure accumulation might simply be wrong. While lithium is traditionally measured in the serum, lithium is better known to accumulate in specific tissues, including the thyroid and brain, according to this paper linked in the article on pharmacokinetics of lithium.
The thyroid gland is very important to weight regulation, and so
true.
To find that lithium concentrations in that organ were second highest in the body is very neatly in line with our expectations. I believe the first highest was the brain. Maybe it shouldn't be a surprise, because lithium therapy is associated with thyroid disease.
Hmm.
The author goes on to discuss a highly technical paper by Dr. Grace Rosen, which thoroughly examines lithium accumulation in brain tissue, providing further evidence for said accumulation.
I just want to say that, The thing where it doesn't bioaccumulate seems to kind of contradict with the part about, whatever environmental contaminant we're looking at probably is present in, it accumulates in because meat makes people more fat in the sense because it bioaccumulates in the meat. And, my point was that in part two or part three, I think it was part three, so that would be the episode released on December 24th, or we aired on December 24th, they talk about how it's very likely that this is more than one contaminant we're looking at here.
And so, likely that more than one route of entrance to the body, too.
So it could be one of several contaminants which need to be looked at for their possible role in this situation.
Yeah, it's more likely to be PFAS stacked on top of lithium than one or the other. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Which, of course, makes this whole entire endeavor a lot more difficult.
Yeah, exactly.
People want like clear-cut results and ideas and magic bullets and stuff. And
one of the things they talk about is how that makes statistical analysis and even determining what the contaminants are incredibly difficult.
Which is why I appreciate so much how much effort they went into being as transparent as possible about their procedures.
Mm-hmm. Part eight of the series is about paradoxical relations.
Reactions.
Paradoxical reactions, which are effects of drugs that are the opposite of what would be expected, such as aggression or arousal from a sedative. The author makes a case for anorexia, which is on the rise, as well as obesity, being such a paradoxical reaction to the compounds that are proposed to be responsible for the obesity epidemic.
And part 9, Anorexia in Animals, discusses a logical extension of this idea of anorexia being a paradoxical reaction to compounds in the environment responsible for the rise in obesity, including context with the fact that lab animals who eat very controlled diets, which haven't changed in decades, are steadily getting more obese. The author makes the case that paradoxical anorexia ought to show up in lab animals, too. Part 10.
So that brings us to the conclusion. And if you're really interested in this, there are like, 10 interludes and
yeah,
a bunch of commentary,
so
back and forth discussion, a lot of details, a lot of sources. And
yeah, they got a lot of comments on Reddit and they spent a whole interlude discussing those comments. It's really interesting, but it's also really nitty gritty. So
we definitely, if you're interested in this, definitely check out slimemoldtimemold.com.
And of course, search under the obesity tag because this currently isn't the top thing on their blog role.
Yeah, we'll have links to that in our show notes at thetruthissoboring.org. This is episode 26, A Chemical Hunger, part 3.
So, 10, what to do about it?
In conclusion, assuming you take our main thesis seriously, that obesity is the result of environmental contaminants, what should you do about it? Our suggestions are very prosaic. Be nice to yourself. Eat mostly what you want. Trust your instincts.
Diet and exercise won't cure obesity, but this is actually good news for diet and exercise. You don't need to put the dream of losing weight on their shoulders, and you can focus on their actual benefits instead. You should focus on your diet, not to get thin, but to make sure you have enough energy to do everything you want to do in life. This means eating enough and making sure that you get what you need. You should exercise, not to slim down, but to gain strength and energy and stamina. And you shouldn't get discouraged when you don't drop 60 pounds fast. Don't be mean to fat people either. If you're fat, don't be mean to yourself about it. It doesn't help, and in all likelihood, will probably just exacerbate the issue.
I also want to say, in addition to don't get discouraged if you don't drop 50 pounds fast, if you do drop 50 pounds fast without really doing anything, but you have done some significant change in your life, like moving to a place with a higher altitude, don't freak out.
Ask your doctor, of course, if you have any concerns.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And also, losing weight very rapidly is a sign of certain diseases too.
I personally I lost 100 pounds within less than a year once, and that was due to changes in my lifestyle, not any particular effort on my own. I just was exercising more and some other environmental changes as well. Don't take my anecdote is the only thing that can happen, but I just wanted to, a lot of people were, kind of freaked out at that. What kind of diet are you doing? I'm like, I'm not. They're like, well, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. I feel healthy, you know?
Yeah, I had similar reactions when I turned into a twig when I hit puberty. It's I had a bunch of, useful seal fat until about age 12, and then I became very skinny, and everyone was like, are you eating enough? And I was like, I think I am.
Like they say, trust your instincts.
And your doctor. Don't just immediately assume that it's because of some new food or whatever you're eating. You should, if your weight changes drastically and you don't have a particular explanation at hand, check with your doctor.
I also think that usually we feel we can kind of instinct that sort of thing, which is why I was emphasizing trust your instinct. But yeah, of course, if you have access to medical care, which in the US might be questionable, then definitely, report those sorts of changes to your doctor.
And this doesn't apply to most of our readers, of course, but just in general, we got to stop spending money on circular nutrition research. It's clearly not going anywhere. this is the author talking. I have an immediate response to that, which is capital will keep milking that cow until it stops giving out money.
Yeah, as long as you can sell people on the diet fad of the week, then that's probably going to continue.
So I guess the advice here would be to stop selling yourself on the diet fad and stop giving attention to people who buy into diet fads because they're fads. Other theories of obesity don't engage with the observations that are out there about the obesity epidemic, and they try to explain the wrong thing. Most theories focus on the dynamics of individual weight loss under the assumption that obesity is the result of the normal mechanics of eating, exercise, weight loss, and weight gain. But we think that the dynamics of individual weight loss have got almost nothing to do with the real question, which is why obesity rates are so much higher now than they were in the 1970s and the rest of human history. Individuals can gain or lose 15 to 20 pounds from their set point, but this is messing around with the range of control. We only care about the set point.
Let's say it's 50 degrees Fahrenheit outside. If your thermostat is set to 72 degrees and you open the door, your house's temperature will drop at first, and then it will go back to the set point of 72 degrees Fahrenheit. If your thermostat is set at 110 degrees Fahrenheit and you open the door, your house's temperature will drop at first, and then it will go back up to the set point of 110 degrees Fahrenheit, assuming your furnace is strong enough.
This is a standard feature of how homeostatic systems respond to major disturbances. The controlled value swings around for a bit until the system can get it back under control and send it back to the set point. So all that diet and exercise studies we've done over the last 50 years or so have just been an exercise in who can create the biggest, most jarring disturbance. But the lipostat, or the set point, always finds a way to bring your weight back to wherever it wants it.
So all these punch the control system as hard as we can studies don't really tell us anything about why the thermostat is set to 110 degrees Fahrenheit in the first place, which is what we're really interested in.
Best-selling nutrition books usually have this part where they tell you what you should do differently to lose weight and stay lean. Many of you are probably looking forward to us making a recommendation like this. We hate to buck the trend, but we don't think that there's much you can do to keep from becoming obese, and not much you can do to drop pounds if you're already overweight.
We gotta emphasize just how pervasive the obesity epidemic really is. Some people do lose lots of weight on occasion, it's true. But in pretty much every group of people in the world, obesity rates just go up, up, up. We'll return to our favorite quote from The Lancet.
Quote, unlike other major causes of preventable death and disability, such as tobacco use, injuries, and infectious diseases, there are no exemplar populations in which the obesity epidemic has ever been reversed by public health measures.
The nonprofit OurWorldInData.org has data on the WHO covering obesity rates in almost every country in the world from 1975 to 2016. In every country in this data set, the obesity rate either stayed the same or increased every single year from 1975 to 2016. There is not one example of obesity rates declining for even a single country in a single year. Countries like Japan and Vietnam are some of the leanest countries in the world, about 4% and 2% obese respectively. But in this data set, at least, even these super lean countries don't see even a single year where their obesity rates decline.
We see the same trend for smaller scale data. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, IHME, has a data set of county level obesity data from 2001-2011, which is publicly available on their website. Using this, we can look at obesity rates across the United States, and we can talk about how much obesity rates have changed in each country between 2001 and 2011. We see that between those years, obesity rates decreased in zero countries, stayed the same.
Counties.
Decreased.
Easy to confuse them.
Okay, I'll start the sentence over. Between the years 2001-2011, obesity rates decreased in zero counties, stayed the same in zero counties, and increased in 3,143 out of 3,143 counties and county equivalents in the United States. That is, obesity has been steadily rising in every single place it was measured in the United States since 2001.
At the county level.
At the county level.
The smallest increase between 2001 and 2011 was in Eagle County, Colorado, where obesity rates went from 20% in 2001 to 21.5% in 2011, an increase of 1.5%. You'll notice that this is Colorado once again, and it turns out that the five counties with the smallest increase from 2001 to 2011 are all in Colorado. Of the 25 counties with the smallest increase, 13 are in Colorado. The take-home here is that Colorado really is special.
If we zoom in a little further on these data, we can find one case of obesity rates declining. They went from 22.7% in 2009 to 22.4% in 2011, and Fairfax City, Virginia, a drop of 0.3%. There were also two counties where rates stayed the same between 2009 and 2011. But this is one county with rates going down, two staying the same, and 3,140 going up. If population level reversals are this tiny and this rare, it's hard to imagine that there is much an individual can do to change their own weight.
But that said, here are a few ideas in approximate order from least extreme to most extreme. First off, there are a few things that won't change how many contaminants you're exposed to, but may have an impact on your weight anyway.
One, the first is that you can put on more muscle mass. This won't affect your weight as it appears on the scale, but it does often seem to affect people's body composition. The lipostat pays attention to how much fat you have, but it also seems to pay attention to how much you literally weigh. See these studies in mice and this recent extension in humans. Those are inline citations. So if you gain muscle mass, you may lose fat mass. For advice on how to gain muscle mass, please see the internet. Or your doctor.
The second is that you could consider getting gastric bypass or a similar related surgery. Our understanding is that these procedures are very effective at causing weight loss in many cases. However, they're pretty dangerous. This is still a surgical procedure, and so inherently comes with the risk of death and other serious complications. You should consider this option. If you consider this option, please take it very seriously, consult with your doctor, etc.
And I would like to remind everyone that since COVID pressure in hospitals has been at an all-time high, elective procedures such as gastric bypass surgery are postponed or being postponed for a lot of people
for
a long time.
Or just unwise in general because it's really dangerous to go to a hospital right now.
Yeah, you'd probably want to stay out of the hospital if you can manage it.
Many of you, however, are not just interested in weight loss. You're interested in weight loss along with reducing how many mystery chemicals you're exposed to. That includes us.
you stupid kids, I don't want to lose weight. I want to get these contaminants out of my body.
Get it out of me. So here's a list of steps you could take to reduce your exposure and possibly lose weight. Again, in approximate order from least to most extreme.
The first thing you should consider is eating more whole foods and or avoiding highly processed foods.
This is a thing that I've personally taken a lot of steps, and I eat a lot more like paleo-style unprocessed foods since reading this.
I don't like the word paleo because it's another fad diet.
I'm not doing it to lose weight. I'm doing it because, like, I see that, like, having less contaminants is more healthy. And, you know, it's just, you know, I don't want to have that bioaccumulation or, like, the accumulation and processing at, you know, factories and stuff like that. And so it kind of does fit in with that. Like, I didn't even put the connection together that it was like the paleo thing until I was talking about it with someone online, and they're like, oh, you're just talking about paleo.
The paleo thing is a little more specific than that. And
oh, okay.
I don't like.
Maybe I'm mistaken.
No, like there are parallels for sure, but it's really expensive.
Mm.
There are a lot of things you just are not allowed to eat that don't make sense to me.
Well, yeah, I said more like that. Like I'm eating like less processed foods in general is what all I meant, I guess.
Yeah, I mean you can eat less processed foods without being paleo. That's all I'm saying.
Well,
because the paleo diet also excludes a lot of stuff that we helped produce through agriculture, through natural artificial selection. Because supposedly
they wouldn't want you to eat wheat. Because that's a cultivated thing.
Or any of the brassicas.
And I'm, like, specifically saying, like, you know, give me a big bag of whole wheat flour and I'll...
And cabbage.
That's where I'm making my bread from. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm saying, like, cabbage, broccoli, kale, like, all of those and just be totally out. All of the corns.
That's ridiculous.
Anyway. So...
Thank you for clearing that up for me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for bringing it up so that I could clear it up. So this is pretty standard health advice. We think it's relevant because it seems pretty clear that food products tend to pick up more contaminants with every step of transportation, packaging, and processing. So eating local, unpackaged, and unprocessed foods should reduce your exposure to most contaminants.
Shout out to the 607 CSA.
Yeah.
The second thing you can do is try to eat fewer animal products. Vegetarians and vegans do seem to be slightly larger than average.
Leaner
than average. But the real reason we recommend this is that we expect that many contaminants will bioaccumulate, and so it's likely that whatever the contaminant, animal products will likely contain more than plants will. So this may not help, but it's a good bet.
Three.
Or, like, it might help with part of the situation, but not all of it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you're still eating, like, packaged mac and cheese and stuff, like, you know, that's not going to help you.
Mm-hmm. Oreos.
Oreos. Annie's. The third thing is you can think about changing careers and switching to a leaner job. Now, this is, of course, in order from least to most extreme, and this is the most extreme thing on this list. Career is a big source
of... No, there are more after that.
Well, yeah, but like these are all separate lists.
Getting to be more extreme, yes.
Career is a big source of variance in obesity rates, so if you have a job in a high obesity profession like truck driver or mechanic, consider switching to a job in a low obesity profession like teacher or surveyor. And I don't understand how teachers who eat constant processed food, because like if you're a teacher and you're eating school food, you're eating processed food all the time, but apparently teachers are leaner. For a sense of what careers are high and low obesity, check out this paper about obesity by occupation in Washington State and this other one about obesity by occupation in U.S. workers. These are inline citations you can easily access at simultimold.com. And of course, if you're already in a pretty lean career, then you can ignore this one. Do you think this goes double if you're in a profession where you're working with lithium grease directly or even around lithium grease? Do what you can to stay away from this stuff.
The fourth thing you consider is changing where you live. The simplest is to change where you live locally. Stay in the same area, but move to a different house or apartment. This one is tricky and sort of a shot in the dark. How will you know if you're moving to a more or less contaminated house? But if you suspect that your house is high in contaminants, it may be worth moving. If you find specific contaminants especially concerning, you can try having your local water tested for them.
And five, a better option is to move to a leaner place altogether. If you're in the United States, we recommend Colorado. Being the leanest state, Colorado has exceptionally pure water sources. Individual cities and counties in Colorado are extreme lean outliers, etc.
I also want to say that the Catskills are, depending on where you live in the Catskills, at least I feel like I've lost weight since I moved here.
It depends if you're drinking the town water, for sure. Like, if you live in the valley, then you live at a lower altitude where more contaminants are present in the groundwater already. If you live up the mountain like we do, lucky us, you probably have access to a well or a spring, and the groundwater out here is not very contaminated because New York City has imposed a lot of decent rules on keeping it clean. So your water is probably exceptionally pure if you live up the mountain in the Catskills too.
Massachusetts is another place that's slightly trailing Colorado. To find your dream location, look at the CDC's list of states or one of the data sets of county-level data, like a few linked in the article, and find a location with a lower rate of obesity than where you currently live. Or pick from one of the places of the list of leanest communities in the U.S.
Side note, Hawaii was originally listed here, but the indigenous people of Hawaii have been asking for decades for people, for settler colonialists to stop moving there, so we do not actually recommend that personally.
Yeah, that seems kind of messed up.
So six, this may not be extreme enough. After all, even Colorado is more than 20% obese. So a more radical version of the same idea is moving to a leaner country altogether, which, I mean... That must be nice if you have the money for that.
Yeah. If you live in the United States, the good news is that most countries are less obese than where you live now, even if you live in Colorado. Especially good choices seem to be Japan, South Korea, and Thailand. But there are many options. For the whole picture, check out the summary from Our World in Data.
But don't just take our word for it. Listen to these happy customers. Like this person, who lost weight over 5 months in Vietnam. Or this person, who moved to Vietnam and lost 112 pounds in 10 months. This person, who lost about 4 kilograms after about 2 months in Japan, and similar stories in the comments section. This other person, who lost 5 pounds on a 2-week trip to Japan. Oh, wow. On a 2-week trip to Japan. Holy crap. Or this person, who lost 10 pounds during a 2-week trip to Japan. Wow. Despite not keeping up with their exercise regimen. Most of these people attribute their weight loss to eating less and walking more, but you'll also notice that most of them say it was easy to eat less and walk more, and that many of them report being surprised at how much weight they lost and how easily they lost it.
Oh, man, there's a... I feel like...
There's a bunch of stories here.
There's, like, a little side tangent there about, like, not just bikes, YouTube channel, and, like, walkable cities and stuff like that.
Because if you feel like you can go walking more, then you have another way to exercise passively, technically, lose a little more or use a little more of the calories that you're taking in.
They have several other examples. I think we can skip those.
Oh, yeah. Look at the time.
Yeah. I also wanted to say, like, something that they don't seem to take into account in this is I learned about in, I don't know. I was having a conversation about this with a friend of mine, and they were saying that something this doesn't consider very much is stress, and how, like, having a more stressful lifestyle at all, like, regardless of, you know, contaminants and stuff like that, will lead to more obesity. So if you're talking about lifestyle changes, you know, reducing stress is another reason to consider that career change option, you know, or something like that, moving or whatever. These examples here.
That was something that was really surprising for me, a person with stress disorders, but no weight disorders, supposedly, except slightly underweight occasionally.
Well, all of these vary very strongly on
genetics. Yeah, that's true.
You know, I'm someone who's clearly very sensitive to these sorts of things, and like whenever I'm exposed to these sorts of situations, my weight can shift rapidly in one direction or the other. But you seem to stay relatively the same regardless, and so that's important to note.
Well. It's certainly very debilitating in all the usual ways. Stress disorders, I mean. The question, what do we do about it, also includes the question, what research comes next? Here's what the article writer is thinking.
A lot of people's first instincts when reading this work are to propose correlational studies. We don't necessarily mean a literal correlation, we just mean something that's not a controlled experiment. But we think that correlational studies are the wrong way to go at this point.
The first reason is statistical. We covered this in part 4, but it bears repeating. Because most of the modern variations in obesity is genetic, the apparent effect of any contaminant will be quite small, probably no larger than R equals 0.5, and maybe a lot smaller. In any study we could run, the range of the variable would probably be restricted, and when the range of a variable is restricted, the correlation always ends up looking up smaller than it really is. Some people have proposed we do animal studies for more control, but this is also a bad choice statistically since the obesity effects in animals seem to be smaller than the effects for humans.
Fun. The combination of these problems means that any correlational study would be searching for a pretty small effect, and that means that you would need a huge sample size to even have a good chance of finding a potential relationship. So, run a quick correlational study starts looking like find a way to fund and organize a study with 1,000 mice. We love mice. This seems like an awful lot of them. And even if we have enough statistical power that we have a 90% chance to detect a relationship, that means that we have a 10% chance of missing the relationship altogether. We don't love those odds.
Second, a chemical hunger already documents a lot of correlational evidence for contaminants in general, and for a few in particular, especially lithium. If you already find this evidence compelling, it's hard to imagine that one more piece of correlational evidence will do anything for you. And if you don't find our view convincing, it's hard to imagine that another piece of correlational evidence will change your mind. The contamination theory of obesity has to be possible in the sense that we know that chemicals can cause weight gain, and we know that various chemicals are in the environment. We hope we've also convinced you that it's plausible, but now we want to figure out, is it actually true? More correlational evidence isn't going to get us there.
So overall, we recommend going right for the jugular. If this theory is correct, and we have a good shot at doing what we really want to do, actually curing obesity, and no result could be more convincing than that. So, in general, we approve of the idea of doing experiments just to cure obesity, straight up. Normally, in public health, it's hard to do this kind of experiment because it's unethical to expose people to dangerous chemicals. Back when they were trying to figure out if cigarettes cause cancer, they didn't do any studies where they assigned people to smoke 3 packs a day. But there's nothing unethical about removing a contaminant from the environment, so we like that approach.
We call these experiments, and they are, but in many cases, we can actually cheat a little by not bothering to include a control group. People almost never spontaneously stop being obese, so we can just use the general obesity rate in the population as our control group.
Generally speaking, there are two approaches. Broad-spectrum experiments take the overall contaminant theory seriously, and just try to reduce contaminant exposure generally without committing to any particular specific contaminant. Targeted experiments go after one contaminant in particular and see if controlling levels of that contaminant alone can lead to weight loss.
These have clear trade-offs. The broad-spectrum experiments are more likely to work and require less governmental control, but if they
experimental control. That's different than governmental control.
Yes, my apologies.
That's all right.
But if they cure obesity, they don't tell us which contaminant is responsible. Curing obesity would still be pretty cool, though. The targeted experiments are less likely to work because we might go after the wrong contaminant, or we might screw up our experimental control and let some contamination through. But if they do work, then we have strong evidence that we found a contaminant that's responsible. They use the word the, but I think a is probably more appropriate because, as they said before, it's more likely that it's either the combined action of multiple or the interactions between multiple contaminants than it is likely to be a single one.
Mm-hmm. For all of these studies, the big hurdle is that we don't know how quickly obesity can be reversed, even under the best circumstances. It might vary a lot for different people. We have no idea. So if we try any of these experiments, we need to run them for several months at the very least, just to get a good idea of whether or not it's working. Maybe if we're lucky, we'll find out you can cure obesity in 2 weeks, but 3 months, 6 months, or even a year seems more plausible. Below, we propose a few basic ideas for the experiments.
Which I really don't think we have time to read through, but okay. You can find easily at simultimal.com
under the section 10. Yeah, I think we're about out of time.
I really love the heading, throw water filters at the problem and see what happens.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's a broad spectrum version of a targeted idea, which just basically involves filtered water.
And we learned this week that it is actually possible to make your own filters, and that's,
That's right.
It's kind of a pain.
It is a pain, but it's totally possible to make your own charcoal and activate it yourself, and then make your own activated charcoal filters for both air and water. And I'd be happy to link some to-dos, or not to-do, how-tos, rather, in the notes on that for any interested parties who might want to experiment. I think they also describe how the Amish are a really good control group because they're a pretty homogenous social group, and there are, like, very clear locational differences regarding the Amish and Amish obesity rates specifically, so you could compare them already without having to do any extra work. It's quite long, though, so that's going to have to be saved to be read.
You can listen to... Let's wrap this up. You can listen to this episode whenever we upload the archives, probably next Wednesday or so. It will be at thetruthissoboring.org. You can listen to episodes 22 and 24 of our radio program there now, which fill in some more of the background on this. You can check out, we'll also have linked to the Slime Mold Time Mold blog.
SlimeMoldTimeMold.com, of course.
Well, specifically, there's like a link to the tag, which contains this whole series. So that will be on our website at thetruthissoboring.org. We will be back in 2 weeks at 9 a.m. for another episode of The Truth is So Boring, as well as tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. for Cat's Chill. I hear Owen is doing going to be playing some idea, perhaps?
Perhaps. We'll see. He swears a lot, so maybe not.
It might be a little bit of work for you. Anyway, thanks for listening, and stick around for Jim Rowder's music.
In conclusion, be excellent to each other. Party on, dudes.